think this is a good time for all three speakers from the previous session to join Scoville for a discussion of the whole morning session. So, Kurt, could you come up, and Jean-Loup, and Amy? And let me raise a question that connects this talk with the earlier talks. What fraction of the total integrated bolometric luminosity of the universe comes from AGN? Puget argues that on the basis of the fact that the hard X-ray background is a small total amount of energy, that probably implies that only a few percent at most of the bolometric luminosity of the universe comes from AGN. Would you agree with that? Also, what's the redshift dependence?
That's not an analysis I've done, but there was a talk which I heard by, I think it was Heckman, maybe, that took following the assumption that 1% of the mass of a bulge was in the central black hole, and then calculating with 10% m dot c squared, how much luminosity would you derive from that accretion? I think he explained quantitatively the total infrared background.
Yeah, I think that's not possible. It just requires a bolometric correction from the hard X-ray, which is of the order of 200. Nobody knows exactly this number. More classical numbers are more like 30 to 50, but I think that's quite an open question. I think observationally, the best way to answer it, if you observe individual objects, as you have shown, there is a trend. The AGN part is getting higher and higher when you go to higher luminosity in this infrared galaxy. So if you want to know what fraction of the background is really due to AGN, I think the best observational way is to correlate the structure of the infrared background with the structure of the X-ray background. And when you look at numbers, basically, ISO, but later assertive, and XMM can do the job. So I think that will give a clean answer about the total.
Yeah, although I worry a little bit that the X-ray to total bolometric luminosity ratio of AGNs may not be a fixed number.
Does anyone else want to comment on that?
Okay.
So Julio wants to raise a different question.
Yeah, Professor Kirk, I was intrigued by your low velocity dispersions of the nebular lines here. So. There were a few galaxies in your sample, a redshift of one, which were actually very comparable, you said, to local large spirals. So I was wondering what happens to them? I mean, if they're also off, the local relationships, is it that the sublimation rates are, distribution is different in a way that we can actually quantify, or what is different about them?
The problem is that we don't have the line widths of the galaxies that have good morphologies from the HDF. We haven't done much spectroscopy in the HDF, so I can't say on a galaxy by galaxy basis what the big ones have for line widths.
Well, but I mean, I'm not an observer, but Nicole Vogt, part of the Deep Project, of course, has done this with morphology from the growth strip, and so comparable big spirals are pretty close, as Dave Koo explained in his talk yesterday, to the Z equals zero Tully Fisher relation. It's these small things that are really quite divergent. Sure, as Kurt emphasized. Actually, let me ask a question to you, Kurt. Well, one of the most intriguing things that you just passed over in your talk was your data on redshift 1.5 to 2.5. And let me ask if the numbers of the bright galaxies at those redshifts are comparable to, or lower or higher than, at redshift 1?
Or at redshift 3?
The problem is that they're much harder to select photometrically, and we have contamination from low redshift galaxies, which... Yeah, but it's too hard to understand our selection effects. We fail in most cases when we try to get spectra. There's a lot of contamination from bright things locally, and it's not an easy calculation. We haven't done it yet.
Based on photometric estimated redshifts, there are at least two or three groups that are saying that the numbers drop substantially between redshift 1 and redshift 2. The trouble is that there are few real redshifts in that range, except for yours, which I don't think are available, to calibrate the photometric redshifts. So do you think we should believe these photometric results?
It's an important question. I don't want to put you on the spot, but I mean, theoretically, this is actually quite interesting.
Well, I think you should believe them to the extent that our galaxies in that redshift range were photometrically selected. Not with the identical technique, but it was based on the colors that we found that they're at the right redshift. So it is possible to pick out galaxies.
Okay. Carlos?
Sorry to jump around a bit, but before we move too far away from the AGN Starburst connection, I just wanted to have a question for Amy and Nick. Nick said at some point earlier on in his talk that there was this raging debate as to what fraction of the energy produced in Ulrichs comes from the AGN and from the starburst. By extension, that debate applies also to the scuba sources, and I was wondering whether which side of the debate, I mean, I know there is a debate, so there's no definitive answer, but I was wondering which side of the debate Nick is in, and Amy, who actually looks at the scuba sources, what does she think about this, particularly given that the ones where she can see an optical counterpart all turn out to be AGNs? So can you comment on this, both of you?
I don't think I have any opinion about the scuba sources, whether they're AGN or starburst. Obviously, this is the material for a starburst, but...
Well, locally, it's clearly difficult to make the distinction, so at high redshift, we have even less of a chance. But, I mean, in terms of if you want to decide what fraction of a single source is actually due to star formation and what fraction, you know, because even locally, there's people think that there's both star formation and AGN taking place in single systems. So I can't. There's no way I can differentiate to that extent. But in terms of having any AGN characteristics at all, it is true that the optically selected sources, the ones that were bright enough to get spectroscopy for, the majority are AGN. Not all. We did have one starburst pair at redshift 2.55. I think it's hard to extrapolate that result to fainter fluxes, fainter optical magnitudes at this point, because clearly this could be a unique part of the population. But as I was mentioning earlier, the Chandra deep X-ray observations have not turned up a large fraction of the sublunar sources as being hard X-ray sources. So that would argue against the majority of the sublunar sources being X-ray sources and therefore being AGN.
You wanted an argument.
So I've got a sort of theoretician's question for everybody up there. We heard from Kurt that his data and his group's data show most of the star formation occurring between redshifts 1 and 3 or 4, but he needs to make large dust corrections of a factor now 7 on the average to the observed luminosity to get an estimate of the star formation rate. All that luminosity, of course, comes out in the far infrared. You heard from Amy that she can only see the very brightest scuba sources. These are very dust obscured and don't even appear in the optical. But she needs to make a factor of 10 correction to what she's seen for the incompleteness for the fainter sources which are below the scuba limits. We already know from Kurt's work and Chuck's work that the brightest, the most rapidly star-forming sources are seen to have the highest extinction. And so the question really is there anything left to understand, or are we actually just seeing the whole population? It seems to me everybody's data is consistent with the scuba sources picking up the very strongest star-forming objects, which have so much dust that everything comes out in the far infrared and basically they're optically invisible. But a lot of the weaker things being picked up at the optical wavelengths, but still with a large dust correction. And so maybe is it now consistent with everybody seeing the two ends effectively of the same population?
And the background all comes out right.
Yeah, and the final thing, I guess Jean-Louis' model for the background showed that essentially a very similar model is consistent with the background data.
Sure. I was just going to say, it's not by any means a solved issue. I would say that it appears to us that the bright lunar population is, in fact, distinct from the optical population. And it could be, in fact, that they're the progenitors of ellipticals, whereas the Lyman-Bright galaxies are the progenitors of smaller bulge systems.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, I mean, the fact is that the sublunar sources, the bright sublunar sources, you would not detect in the optical. So when you talk about Lyman-Bray galaxies, I mean, it's in terms of what kind of objects they're selecting. It's a selection effect, right? I mean, they're just able to see sources that are at those redshifts that are bright enough that you can actually, you know, look at the colors and decide. The SCUBA systems are extremely rapid star formers, okay? So they're not going to fall into a category of 20 to 30 solar masses per year. I mean, we're talking hundreds of solar masses per year. So it depends what you decide is your discriminating factor. I mean, what makes a distinct source? I mean, if you have something that's an extremely strong star former versus something that's just a normal star former, doesn't that say a lot about what the processes are that are creating that source?
I have a follow-on question on what Simon was saying. When referring to redshifts beyond one, all three of the first speakers basically were discussing different ways to look at stars younger than about 10 to the 7 years, right, with the hope that if you wanted to know what the total number of stars formed down to a certain redshift was, that was simply the integral over this inference. At Z equals zero, I think we have a pretty good idea of what the sum of all stars at all ages is. What are the constraints on the total sum of older stars at redshifts beyond one? Are there any?
Sounds like a question.
No, it's not really a question for me.
Background question.
I think the only thing I can say to that is that the attempt to model, in fact, the background, there have been a number of models, and we'll hear about that this afternoon, but the Guidardini model, the Franceschini model, and some of the model that Mike is going to talk about this afternoon, seems to be able to give a self-consistent picture between filling the background and at the same time fitting with the total number of observed stars and heavy elements and so on. So that's what my feeling. Now, just a short word about what the question of Simon. My feeling is really that there is no inconsistency. It's not a proof that it works that way, but we have a self-consistent picture that this infrared background is dominated by few 10 to the 11 solar luminosity infrared galaxies, and what we are seeing is a fraction of that, which depends on the sources at 15 microns, at 150 or at 850. We get a fraction of that because we picked up only the highest luminous detail up to a degree, but there is no inconsistency.
Martin Heidel, did you still want to make a comment about... Okay. And then Jeff Heidel.
The comment I want to make was just that one should still keep in mind that at the bolometric peak of the infrared background, we haven't resolved the background. So in principle, we could have basically still missing the sources that are making the background completely. So if you have that discussion, if what the AGN contribution is, it could turn out that neither the SCUBA sources are dominated by AGN, nor the ULUGs are dominated by AGN, and nevertheless, the AGN might make up most of the infrared background, and they are just sitting at the temperature of the dust, that they're coming there, that you can't see them either with SCUBA at the moment, nor see them later on because they die out in redshift. So I think there's still quite a leeway to introduce something new. In principle, the hard X-ray background sources could have a spectrum in the infrared that they basically make up the infrared background without showing up with SCUBA by just changing the dust temperature a bit.
Of course. In fact, this is a general discussion. So
this is a picture that that maybe Kurt should have shown. This is from a paper by Kurt and me that came out recently, or at least on AstroPH. And I think you could actually understand a lot of what's been discussed here through the following, through this diagram. Basically, these are the actual SCUBA counts at 850 microns, and this solid line is our best guess about what we would predict those counts to be from objects that were discovered in the UV. Now, the things that are very heavily extinguished tend to be the most luminous, and we clearly underpredict those. But the things that are producing most of the background, as other people have said, are things around 1 millijansky or so, plus or minus a factor of a few. And those are just the things that we can find very well. And this is actually what our prediction would be for the relative contribution to the background. And these are the actual counts of SCUBA sources as a function of flux. So I don't think there is any discrepancy here.
First one is, I mean, we kind of know locally that there's a difference between the ultra-luminous galaxies and more normal galaxies and their physical mechanism, right? And there really is a, as Nick's described in detail, right, quite a difference. Quite a difference in the physical mechanism between the two populations. It's not unnatural to suppose that that's going to be present at the higher redshift as well, I think, right? And therefore, there probably is some difference between the levels of things. As regards to the issue, the broader issue of the populations and whether there's consistency or not, I think there is some level of consistency in the sense that some fraction of the EBR critically must come from the Lyman Break galaxies just because of the dust correction. And clearly, from the Peacock results, right, I mean, which I think are the most compelling evidence on this at the minute, at the few tenths of a millijansky level, right, there probably is a substantial contribution from those. I think by the time you get up above a millijansky, 2 millijansky, those things are turning into the Jülich population. And I rather think the physical mechanism on that really is rather different. So that would be my take on this. I did want to make a comment on the hard X-ray background as well, because we actually do now know the answer to this. Right? And the answer to this is roughly half of the hard X-ray background is coming from low redshift galaxies. Right? I mean, and those galaxies are in the 0 to 1 redshift range. Right? And that says instantly, right, that you have somewhat of a problem at some level, right? Because in fact, you know that there are a lot of nuclei that which are active that you haven't actually picked up before, which presumably contribute to the 170 micron sources just by the argument that you expect the ratio to be at some level. And therefore, this problem really isn't quite solved yet. It's got some hidden gotchas still hanging around in this, right, that we're probably going to have to deal with over the next year or two. So I think there's still some problems.
Jerry?
My question is a variant on Simon Weiss' question. The first three people approaching it from different points of views were deriving essentially Madow backgrounds, either from the optical or for SCUBA or for the total background. And if you were to just ask one question, what's the peak star formation rate? And ask what's the redshift at which that occurs. I think in terms of solar masses per cubic megaparsec per year, my reading of the view graphs that went by is that all three were roughly agreeing. But I'd be both at the on the epoch, 2 to 3, and the number about a quarter. But I'm just curious if you were to derive from your different analyses what the number would be and the redshift, I'd be interested to know whether the three of you agree.
My concern has always been that they all agree, but they all say that their sources account for the total background. And I think that's what Simon was getting. Right, yeah. I mean, I was referring to the optical versus submillimeter source counts, not the background estimates.
All right,
I don't think that's actually the case. I don't think the... I don't think they account for all the background their source counts, do they? But the basic problem is that we're all relying upon luminosity distributions. What?
Okay. If I had to pick a redshift where it peaked, I would pick somewhere in redshift 1 to 3, but I think it's very uncertain. The way the Madow curve has been derived is definitely wrong in detail. For example, people have assumed a luminosity function shape, which is wildly inconsistent with what we see at redshift 1. It's much steeper than the assumption. So. I mean, the data's so poor, it'd almost be meaningless to guess.
And what would you get as a number?
Jerry, on the plot, in one of the plots I showed, first, what we derived was the production rate of infrared as a function of redshift, which is the thing which is fairly safe. Then, there is the problem of the AGN and so on. But if I forget about the AGN contribution and just use the standard conversion and compare that to the number from the corrected Laman Bragg galaxies, it's very close. That's what I showed, and it's basically consistent with the error bars.
It's time to inject some skepticism into this. In response to to Simon's remarks, if we've seen it all in these things that are either compact objects, Z of 1 to 3 in the optical, or ARP 220 analogs, one conclusion I draw is that 90% of the stars in the local universe are in bulges and ellipticals. Or, well, it's a factor of 15% if everybody's multiplying by a factor of 7, 90% if they're multiplying by a factor of 10. And I have a problem with that. Comment, too, and these are rhetorical comments that they can respond to. Something closer to half makes me less uncomfortable. Yeah, but 90% sounds like a lot. The other thing is Todd, in his first talk, mapped the Madow plot onto linear time, which isn't done very often. And I would just remark there are a lot of assumptions that have gone in. No extinction evolution with time, no metallicity evolution of time. It doesn't take much of, if those local rates are underestimated relative to the distant ones by a couple of factors of 1.5, it doesn't take much to drive the, let's say, 10% up to 20 or 30% and change, qualitatively change the picture. And Len and his group has written a paper recently that makes that argument that the fall off to Z of 0 is a lot shallower. And it doesn't look like much in mapping against Z, but integrated over time, it can have a big effect. I'll respond.
Actually, why don't you pass it back to Stacy?
So my question is sort of related to that. It just, as somebody who doesn't do this, it seems to me that there's a lot of dust at high redshift, and that has to be made in some finite amount of time. I remember Mike Edmonds pointing out that you need a really very large amount of mass to explain the sort of scuba type objects that we're being talked about. So my question is a very general one to anyone. I mean, has anybody worked out in detail whether the amount of dust is actually reasonable in terms of just how we think it's made and the metals and stars and then producing the dust afterwards in time for there to be this much at a redshift of 3 or something?
Raised his hand earlier, and he certainly spent some time thinking about this very question.
I was actually going to ask a question on an entirely different subject, but since you have, it is possible to make models that do that, and But of course, the issue about individual objects is a more complex one. It may be that an object enriches itself very quickly when it starts making stars, and so that the evolution of individual objects won't track the sort of cosmic history of the production of metals and dust. And so it may be that, you know, the objects that are lit up at high redshift just come with a sort of fully populated, very heavily dust-obscured system. It just may be that there are fewer of them. But in a global sense, what you say is true. I mean, obviously, you have to, there's a consistency check you have to do. And we've tried to make models that do that, and they work out all right, and they give star formation histories like the ones that have been talked about here as well.
Well, for the things that self-enrich in a very deep amount of time, would you expect the dust properties to be different in any important way?
Oh, I think that's a very complex thing. I think that'd be hard to answer.
You had a separate question.
Yeah, I had a question. This is for Kurt. I'm very interested that you can do a census of galaxies at a redshift of 1 and determine velocity dispersions for these objects. And so I guess so it would be very interesting to ask whether the number of objects as a function of their velocity dispersion is the same at a redshift of 1 as it is today. In other words, if you count the number of objects that you see down to a velocity dispersion of 50 or 60 or whatever, and compare that with the same number per co-moving volume today, is the number bigger or smaller? In other words, were there more galaxies at a fixed potential well depth in the past than there are today?
I have a rough idea of the answer at redshift 1. I'm not sure what the local value is.
So this is doable.
I mean, there's problems because we might be incomplete and who knows what we're missing, but it's doable on a rough one.
It depends on understanding exactly what the oxygen line rate
is. Yes.
But you can do similar observations in
there. You don't have the same structure at one time.
They look the same on the line.
No, they don't. Most of them are much smaller. They don't.
They move compact galaxies. Ali has a question.
I wanted to address the issue of the starburst AGN connection, and in particular whether it's generic. In other words, whether the high redshift quasars also are associated with starbursts. And an argument against that is that the few quasars where we have gravitational lensing information about appear to be very compact. In some of them, we do see evidence for microlensing, which indicates that most of the light comes from within 10 to the 16 centimeters from the center. And so if you had a starburst, which is very powerful, wouldn't you get much more light coming from the extended part of the galaxy? And so that, I guess, this question is primarily addressed at Nick.
I'm not really sure how to answer it, but Dewey cycle is probably one. There are some, like the Fogelius quasar, which appears in some of these plots, I can't remember if it was, which obviously is a background quasar, a gravitational lens. That it has very strong submillimeter and CO component associated with it. And it's clearly a gas rich, really almost a Euler type of.
But is there an extended infrared emission from around the quasar?
From the same object.
Yeah, there is.
Last question, Alvio. This is a theoretician question for Emmy. ALMA in some 6 or 7 years will be able to see very faint objects at redshift 10. What is the chance, if they exist, of course, what is the chance to get redshifts from them? By any other method, if there is a method.
The faint fluxes, the current VLA capabilities aren't sufficiently good. So the kilometer array will be necessary to be able to do any kind of radio or millimeter comparison.
But that ratio was running flat.
fact 1 to 6. So if the US announces a redshift, say, after 20 and redshift 10, you detect it beautifully, you will identify it because
the
spatial resolution with 7-meter array. Spatial resolution is perfect. How do you get the redshift? This is the question.
The bandwidth of the ALMA array should be about 8 gigahertz, and at the lowest frequencies, at 8 gigahertz is delta nu over nu of 20%. So that would mean that, in principle, you could measure a CO line with 20% chance of getting it blind. And obviously, you know, the other lines all become get redshifted down into your spectral band, so it's not like you, at some redshift, lose all the objects. I mean, there are a few windows where you lose them, but. What's that? Yeah, it's good. I mean, the ALMA will be fantastic for this type of study because you'll not only get these submillimeter sources, but from the CO lines you can get dynamical masses of these sources. So you can tell directly what the gas to total mass ratio is and therefore what the state of evolution of it is. And I think that's much better than optical emission lines.
Just on the photometric redshift or the ratio between, let's say, submillimeter and radio, one thing which will help is that you will be able to get with ALMA 350 micron or 450 micron, for which the ratio is not going to be as flat as it is at high redshift as it is for 850, because you are still in the decreasing curve longer, so it helps.
But the thing is, radio emission is going to start to be quenched by microwave.
Yeah.
Okay, Simon wanted to make a final comment. I'll
just make a brief announcement by popular request. Another short break in this afternoon's schedule because we have our session after lunch. So the revised schedule here, there'll be a 20-minute break at 4 o'clock after Ali Loeb's talk, provided we keep the afternoon session on time.
So come back by 1:30.